Dr. David Cartland is a general practitioner, a medical science degree graduate, and published scientist in angiogenesis research. He's faced severe consequences for questioning the science surrounding the pandemic. In this episode of Eyes Wide Open, Dr. Cartland joins me to share his experiences and discuss the growing pushback against the mainstream narrative within the medical profession. Dr. Cartland's bravery in speaking out has led him to establish a private practice which has become a sanctuary for those who have been adversely affected by vaccines and are seeking treatment without being dismissed by the NHS. During our conversation, we delve into Dr. Cartland's awakening, his personal experiences after taking the vaccine, and the challenges he has faced as a result of his outspokenness. I'm Lawrence Eastman, and this is Eyes Wide Open. Dr. David Cartland, welcome to Eyes Wide Open. It's a great honour to have you on.
Thanks for having me. The honour's mine.
So we follow each other on Twitter and keep abreast of your tweets, and you're quite revolutionary for NHS GP. It's quite inspirational, really, to see your posts on Twitter, and they give me great joy, is that you don't pull any punches. You're an honest man and you're fearless. You're not afraid of what the system has in store for you or what they're threatening, because you're one of the very few doctors to speak out during the pandemic, and you received quite a bit of persecution and harassment for your questioning of the science, which is what we should all do. We should never trust the science. We should question the science. Tell me a little bit about what happened to you as a doctor who was speaking out on behalf of his patients.
Thanks for the introduction. I mean, it's been a tricky few years, really, as you mentioned. As doctors, we are conformists. We have consensus opinion is what I'm reminded of these days. I should follow the consensus and should have kept my head down and shrugged my shoulders. That's an exact quote from a senior doctor locally. But, you know, all I've done, as you just mentioned, science really is about asking questions, you know, hypothesis testing, critiquing data, looking at statistics, etc. And all I've really done is, I didn't wake up one day particularly and say I'm going to be an anti-vaxxer. You know, I've took the vaccine myself for different reasons, but the last reason was for heavy coercion, really, to keep my job. And, you know, right back at the beginning, just something didn't seem right about this pandemic, that, you know, it was very quiet in the early days, you know, when I was working in the Midlands at the time, and just very quiet days. I used to call it the England match effect, where, you know, people don't go to the doctors or the hospital when the England game's on in the World Cup. And it was like that. And, you know, GP surgeries were quiet. Hospitals were equally quiet because I was working in hospitals, visiting hospitals. And it was just a kind of observational 12 months initially. And then I moved down to the Southwest Cornwall for, ironically, a sort of change in work-life balance, and just started to see some of the things around the vaccine clinics, you know, firstly just being very very unethical in the way that they practiced. You know, firstly, you know, one of my first stances has really been about informed consent, giving patients the information that's required to make a decision. And that's an ethical principle enshrined in the whole of the history of medicine, really, that you enter a transaction with a patient, a trusting relationship whereby you give them the correct information, pros and the cons of a treatment option, and then you get them to choose. And if they choose against what you think is the wise thing, then that's valid. That's valid as long as they are aware of the consequences. And that was never done in the vaccine centres. It was, you know, four or five patients herded into a room in a 5-minute window, jab, 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 jab. No questions asked, no information provided. In fact, they provided a small amount of information, but after the vaccine had been given, and the vaccine was being given by any man and his dog, you know, there were non-medical people, you know, holding the syringe and pressing it down and, you know, having pots and pans banged about them the very evening after, and just seemed very odd, you know, that the informed consent was being ignored. And then came the coercion. You know, they sacked a load of carers. They were about to come for us doctors. The reason I took my second jab was because it was, you know, you've got to have this jab else you'll be sacked. And that didn't sit right. And then just it really became me observing things in my own clinic with my own eyes, that patients came to me, you know, I had the vaccine yesterday and today this has happened to me, or a week down the line, and I was previously fit and healthy, you know. And there was one common denominator that I was seeing a lot in my very early sort of concern phase of this. And, you know, people were, you know, they were linking it to the vaccine, but doctors weren't. They were coming to me for second opinion, saying the doctors just said it's one of those things. And, you know, that close temporal relationship at least has to register the vaccine as something on the differential diagnosis. I tried to speak out to my practice managers, partners, senior partners, colleagues. You know, are you guys seeing the amount of clots that I'm seeing at the moment? Are you guys seeing the, you know, strange range of autoimmune conditions, neurology, cardiac presentations in young people? You know, and there was one perilous day where there were a couple of patients that had died from a quite a small surgery in Cornwall, and the death certificates read AstraZeneca, COVID-19 vaccine, cause of death. You know, in the same week, we got a chap who was 41 the very next day after the vaccine, the AstraZeneca, once again, had a cerebral venous thrombosis, which, you know, was the day after the AstraZeneca. And I remember querying the neurologist who rang me, and he just said, "You're not one of those anti-vaxxers, are you, doctor?" When all I've merely said is, "You do know he had the AstraZeneca jab yesterday." And of course now, you know, the AstraZeneca has been pulled, you know, very silently, quietly pulled from the market. And aside from that, I took that information to my bosses that day, and they just shrugged it off and went on and vaccinated folk, you know, 500 times over with the AstraZeneca jab that day. You know, and I could never equate that. And, you know, I've tried to do it the right way. You know, we're supposed to be promoted in the medical profession to, I've just been working in a surgery this week with a massive poster up, tweeted it out. You know, whistleblowing freedom to speak up, guardianship. You know, if you've got any concerns about anything from organisational things to clinical things, speak up freely without any, you know, any anything that will be used against you. And then a doctor like me has done that, and you know, it's cost me my career pretty much.
Based upon your tweets, is that you're quite red pilled in lots of different areas? It's not just in medicine, right? So what I'm trying to understand is that something you've always been, is aware of the wider agenda that's going on, because it's coming at us from multiple angles? Or is that once you found yourself as a whistleblower within the NHS, did all of that conditioning all drop in one go, and then all of a sudden everything opened up to you as the wider agenda?
Yeah, I don't think there was a particular day that I swallowed the red pill, but once you swallow it, it's one of my manifestations, which is you wake up to everything and the whole agenda. Look, I've never heard of Klaus Schwab or the World Economic Forum. I've never heard of any of this stuff. You know, I was happily, you know, at 39 years of age, you know, working a couple of days a week and surfing, and or learning to surf anyway, and just, you know, living the dream. And then suddenly, you know, not only does the COVID scandemic, call it what you like, happened, but then you start mixing in certain communities, and people say, "Have you heard of this? Have you heard of that?" And you know, everything I research for myself, I don't take anyone's word as gospel. And you know, people will say, "Oh, well, you were hanging around with anti-vaxxers or conspiracy theorists or red pillars or
with the wrong gang."
But everything, I mean, every time, even when I see a vaccine injured patient now, I always try and think, you know, what is the alternative explanation? And try and not label everyone as vaccine injured or label everyone as anything, really. Research everything. And that's been really hard to take through all of this. I've tried to back everything I've done with data, references. You know, when I've done interviews very early on in the sort of stepping out of the shadows, I've held up documents to camera saying, "This is not a misinformation, it's camera. You know, this is a document from Pfizer, MHRA, ACBI. Read it out," holding it up to the camera, only to then be deleted from social media. LinkedIn, for example, deleted me for the interview I'm talking about, for holding up pieces of paper from the government and clinical trials.
I think it's important to state your credentials here, so to understand how you have been a product of the system in terms of your training up to this point in life. Is that you're not just a general practitioner for the NHS, is that you've also been a scientist before you became a GP. So you've actually gone right through the entire matrix of conditioning, at least from the big pharma medicine perspective. You know, so for you to be taken off social media and banned, how did that make you feel as someone with those level of credentials? And was it, you know, was it a real eye-opening moment for you and the people around you that someone with your credentials was holding up clear evidence of wrongdoing or clear evidence of deceit by the institution within which you've spent most of your adult life, I guess? What was that like?
Well, it's like you said earlier, you know, science is about debate and discussion. And, you know, if there's no debate and discussion, that's very anti-science from the outset. But somebody with the right credentials, you know, I always have to keep dropping what my qualifications are in the coffee room, because you kind of almost have to justify your space in the anti-vax arena, if you want to call it anything. But, you know, like you said, I've been right through the system, you know, both as a doctor, and I've done, and it's really important to compare and contrast how both degrees are in terms of the science degree and the research that I did and the published science that I did. It looks into a totally different realm of science, looking at root cause analysis, you know, pathophysiology, how did disease happen and how do you address the root cause at a scientific level, whereas you do the MBCHB program, which is the medical degree, and it's very skeletal learning. You do, you know, I did a 4-year degree and it was rapid fire, 2 weeks of obs and gynae, 4 weeks of this, 3 weeks of that. And you do placements here, there and everywhere. Sometimes you don't do any placements in, like I know GPs that have qualified as GPs without having done paediatrics or obstetrics. So they're filling gaps in the NHS rota. So they come out of the GP training without anything relevant to general practice. And, you know, you learn this kind of algorithmic learning. You know, you always feel uncomfortable stepping out of the groupthink or the consensus way of doing it. You know, I did it a very strange way, doing a degree, master's, and then into medicine. And that was uncomfortable. Most people just go straight out of A-levels, straight into that, you know, machine learning university system. And everything ends with drugs. And I've only noticed that since I've stepped away. In fact, I've just done a couple of NHS shifts this week where you kind of feel yourself in that arena, go back to old habits, drugs for every single presentation. It's kind of because you've got such little time with the patients, what, 10 minutes, 32 times a day with no break in between, you just end up following patterns and recognising symptoms and red flags and give a pill for every ill, as I call it. And, you know, you're pretty much just pimping out big pharma.
How does that, you know, that must be quite an experience for you, is that you've come through the system, you've woke up to the nature of the big pharma medicine matrix, which is, it's like doom, isn't it, when you learn about that, right? And that what's happening in medicine is not so much a healing commitment, it's merely, okay, big pharma has these drugs, this book tells me that if I diagnose this condition, I give them that drug. And it's not like a holistic approach to understanding your patients, which you'd need time to do, and, you know, having other modalities of healing. It's like, you know, it's a pick and mix, isn't it? But you're just putting forward, you know, these drugs from Big Pharma, and it's not in the interests of the business model of Big Pharma to cure the patient, because they lose a customer for every cured patient. Is that something you're now starting to see from being inside the system and being red-pilled at the same time?
No, you're right. It's not a brilliant business model, is it, curing patients if you're Big Pharma? You know, it doesn't make much profit. But, you know, I've seen that. You know, a lot of the NHS, like what we call the NICE guidance now, is, you know, it skips that level now where you, because of time pressures and, you know, throw in a scandemic as well, you know, everyone's sort of months and months behind and the queues are building. And so you're just finding that you skip over. I'll give you an example, like diabetes management, hypertension management. You walk into my clinic room and your blood pressure's a bit high. The first thing you look at is lifestyle and holistic things, naturopathic things. You know, look at the portion sizes that you're eating, look what's on your plate, look at the fitness levels, you know, what can you do, what's reasonably, you know, you can't
tell anything. Is that from your perspective, though, or is that within the NHS guidelines now?
I mean, the guidance is for both conditions, blood pressure, and unless it's through the roof or your HbA1c is through the roof, then you should embark upon a 6 months of intensive lifestyle intervention. That's in there, you know, at stage one, but you skip over that now and you skip down to the first drug on the algorithm, depending on certain factors. And then, you know, you get side effects to that drug. And so you either add a drug in or drop the dose and add in another drug that alleviates a side effect. So another pill, because you've used that pill. And so some people are coming into your room with 30 pills that they take for different conditions. Wow. Polypharmacy, and a lot of what I do now is looking at rationalizing, you know, you had that blood pressure pill started in when you were 50 and you were morbidly obese and you were not doing any exercise. Now you've changed things, but you're still taking your amlodipine. So do you need it? So let's go right back to first principle. Do you need it? And get people to monitor their blood pressure again. And doctors don't do that anymore. You know that. we need to start getting people off their pills. But again, that doesn't line the pockets of the people that fund.
See, the NHS feels to me as if it's just a monopoly of Big Pharma, but it's a state-funded monopoly of Big Pharma. It's, you know, we are forced to pay taxes in order to keep the NHS going. But at the same time, is that it feels as if it's nothing more than a racket that's being run by Big Pharma. Now, accidents and emergency is second to none, or used to be before COVID. I don't know what it's like now, but it seems outside of accidents and emergency, which is this treatment plans that we're seeing for these diseases and stuff, it's just a case of what's in the DSM or whatever manual it is, and just pimp those drugs out. Is that a good assessment of what's happening with the NHS?
I would say, yeah, I would say, I mean, unfortunately, my career has really spanned across the 10 years where it's, I keep calling it the Titanic after the iceberg, really, that I think A&E's deteriorated really now. I don't think there's an happy A&E doctor around now, because you start a shift and there's 15 ambulances outside the building. This is our local hospital in Cornwall. By the end of the shift, you've worked like a dog. You've not had a wee break. You've almost self-categorized, not eaten, not drank, and you leave the building 12 hours later and there's 25 ambulances. And you've worked incessantly. So, you know, it's all the way through the system, you know, even in primary care where I work now, you know, you come to me and you've got symptoms of a rheumatological condition. I do some blood tests. It confirms that that's probably likely. And then you get referred to rheumatology. Good luck if you're going to get seen in 18 months to start the medicine that you need, you know, in that period. You know, there's certain things that still lean towards you need allopathic medicines, things like rheumatological conditions, you know, but you're not going to get seen that rheumatologist. Similarly to dermatology, if I've tried a potion and a lotion to help that skin condition and I've got to the point where I can't do it at primary care level, send you to dermatology, good luck, 12 months and the rest, physio, acute bad back, 8 to 10 weeks. If you're lucky, neurology is something like 18 months. You have to have a premonition that you're going to come down with a neurological problem, you know, we're seeing that in the vaccine injury arena now. People have got acute neurological problems and they get referred, only to be seen in 2024.
So now that you've got some deeper insights into the true nature of Big Pharma medicine and the wider agenda, what do you think the whole vaccine rollout was about? Was it simply a money-making exercise from Big Pharma? Or did it have wider implications? Because you're on the front line, you're seeing people who are injured more and more, I guess, because of your position now within the culture as a GP, as a healer, as a doctor who is saying, I'll listen to you about what these vaccine injuries, what's your take? What's your instincts telling you about what happened and what is happening?
Yeah, it's that's a big question, actually, and I'll try not to speculate too much, but I'm allowed an opinion. That's how I feel these days and free to express it. But, you know, to use the phrase, the great reset needs a great collapse, doesn't it? And so, you know, nothing better than to collapse people's trust in the medical profession, totally. The government, the healthcare system fully, than to run the 3 years the way they've been run. You know, utter calamity, utter anti-science, propaganda everywhere you look. Illogical measures, you know, 1 week the government were paying for a meal, half a meal, the next week you can go to a funeral with more than 10 people, then they paid for half your meal again, and then back again that you can't go outside in groups of six, etc. You can put a mask, you've got to put your mask on to walk through the pub. As soon as you pick the burger up, show my dietary choices now, you pick your burger up, you take your mask off. You know, I've been made to wear a filthy face mask walking through a pub. I need to be able to take it. I mean, it's just destroyed trust, doesn't it, really? And I guess the only way you can start afresh and build back better, to use it, is to break what went before it. And it's certainly broken.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I already had a lot of distrust and suspicion of the whole medicine matrix because, you know, of the nature of Big Pharma. But it's still held in some regard. But after what happened during the last 3 years, it seemed as if they saw the trust that had been built in medicine over the last century, and they saw it as a perfect opportunity to abuse that trust, because they knew people, to a large degree, transfer their own sovereignty in various institutions in our society, and medicine being one, is that people trust doctors, or did trust doctors, and will listen to them intently. And I feel as if they abuse that trust. Well, they did abuse that trust, and I can't see how they can restore faith in medicine, at least in this Rockefeller allopathic big pharma model that we have currently. There's still a large portion of the population, I guess, that are fully on board with it. They're getting the latest booster, they're getting the latest jab. There's still people out there that are bought in, but I'd say there's a large portion of the population, and probably growing as more news of vaccine injuries becomes known to the public, is that there is a collapse, a total collapse in trust for that institution. And I don't see how that can be rebuilt other than a totally new paradigm in medicine. You find something similar with your experiences on the ground?
Yeah, and just to touch on what you just said, really, I mean, it is all about trust. You know, when you go in to see that doctor, I mean, even the last 2 days, people come in to see you with their most darkest intimate secrets or embarrassing problems. And, you know, that trust is so paramount. And so, you know, that's been, like you say, it's been hopped upon by the powers that be, I'll say, without speculating, that have used that trust that has took many, many years to build up. And it's hoodwinked, because, you know, I think the doctors trust the government and the officials that are making these big scientific decisions, because they haven't got time to research for themselves. That's clearly obvious. They don't even know it's mRNA, some doctors. You know, that's even up until the last few weeks. And then obviously the patients believe the gospel account of vaccines being safe and effective, because it's come from the doctor's mouths or the nurse's mouth, because of that trust that we've talked about. So, you know, there's a bit of a sort of chain of command, isn't there? And they've leapt on trust, definitely, as a tool in which to hoodwink the public. Full stop. You know, it's certainly not safe or effective. We all know that now.
But it's the doctor's role is almost like a psychologist, isn't it, as well? Right? Because the power of placebo, you must know about that. And, you know, in medicine, is that it's extremely powerful, and it can cause mind over matter. So when you go into a doctor's surgery, you've already agreed to be part of that whole psychological experience, in which a doctor can give you good news, he can give you bad news, he can give you a pill to cure things, and the psychological placebo effect and nocebo effect can, you know, heal patients just by magic, you know. So I think when you broke that trust, then that power that the doctor once had over the psyche of the patients is vastly diminished.
Yeah, as you mentioned, that placebo effect is massive in what we do. You know, just going to see the doctor and the doctor saying it will be okay, even though they've given that absolutely no intervention. I you know, 50% of the time, I reckon I could give a sugar pill to somebody and say it's an antidepressant and it would make your mood better. And if I suggest to them that, you know, their mood lability will be less, and their mood will elevate, their energy levels will go up, then 2 or 3 weeks later, Dr. Carlton suggested that. And, you know, they did that placebo effect plays out massively, you know.
What do you think about that as a doctor? Do you ponder on that question about the placebo power of your role in society? Because I think that in itself is really interesting, is, you know, the psychological power of the doctor's role.
Exactly. It is power, and it's responsibility, and it needs to be respected and, you know, firstly managed in an ethical way. Because once you lose the ethics from practice, then you can abuse that power and abuse that trust and that responsibility. So, and we've seen that with the COVID pandemic, that it's been abused. This whole, you know, safe and effective mantra, it's broken.
Well, that was a placebo, wasn't it, in a sense? Yeah. Is that, you know, they built the fear. They built the fear through the media. Right, they got everyone terrified of catching this invisible disease. You know, the media was fully on board, the politicians were on board, the scientists were on board, the doctors, and they whipped up the nation into this fear. And then came the solution, which was the placebo of the vaccine. Yeah, because now it realizes that it didn't do anything at all other than, you know, hurt people and damage them. And you could see it all play out. And I did an interview with Matthias Desmet, who talked about this, about the whole mass formation, about how the state manipulates the populations. But now that it's coming out, are you, because you left the NHS for a while, didn't you? Set up a private practice, and that private practice is going really well for you. how are you finding being a doctor in a private practice compared to the NHS, and what kind of patients is that practice bringing in for you?
Yeah, so I've set up a kind of telemedicine service, as you mentioned, so having a conversation like we are now, really, and it's really vastly become a vaccine injury service, and the way that's come about really is because people will, for example, they'll be perfectly healthy in their 20s, took the vaccine because, you know, for the right reasons, to contribute to humanity's, you know, goal of getting rid of this deadly disease, in inverted commas, and take one for the team, and it's safe and effective, so why wouldn't you? And, you know, you get the added bonus of being able to fly to the countries that you wish to, which, you know, that feeds into the psychology as well, doesn't it? Having these freedoms taken away from you that really shouldn't, they had no right to take away, certainly wasn't scientific. I forgot what I was going to say now.
Okay, so we were just talking about your private practice and bringing and speaking with, becoming a specialist for vaccine damaged people, because you're putting your hand up and saying, I'm one of you guys, because you've taken the vaccine yourself. You're not happy about some of the after effects, but you're providing a space for people to come and, you know, be listened to by a medical professional.
You've just seen what happens. That's my kind of, I don't call it a vaccine injury, but that brain fog you've just saw, I can be talking and lo and behold, what just happened. Just, I completely lost my train of thought.
How do you feel about that?
It's a concern. It's only been since the vaccine, you know, I played a lot of football in my life, you know, headed a lot of football. There's footballs from the back line, you know, so there may be a contributory factor from that. But
is that the latest headline, is if heading football causes the death suddenly?
Either that or the referee's whistle or that alarm clock going off too early.
Okay.
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, the brain fog and the mental fatigue is a real phenomenon I've experienced. I take all the supplements that I recommend to the vaccine injured. But like I say, all the stories I get from the vaccine injury cases that I deal with are all the same. They're healthy, they're fit, they take the vaccine for the right reasons, as we just touched on. And then within a close proximity of time, they develop symptom X, Y, and Z. They then take that symptom to their GP to be instantly dismissed, and everyone describes the same thing. They literally, as soon as they mention the V word, they notice this change in demeanor from the doctor. They notice this change in attitude of the doctor, almost aggressive towards them. And they say with absolute 100% confidence, this could not be the vaccine. It's just a coincidence. They get told to pull themselves together, to stop acting, you know, these are some of the quotes from patients. And, you know, the service I provide, firstly, more than anything, it's a listening service. It's a service where you're not going to get dismissed and gaslit. And that's one of the things that's really made me angry, you know, in all of this, is that the patient, the stories I get from the vaccine injured, it's this gaslighting from the doctors. They're having to chase the doctor around the building to get a heart scan for a chest pain. You know, we all know that there's that association between the mRNA vaccines and myocarditis. And yet a 27-year-old can present with breathlessness and chest pain and be told it's muscular over a telephone, or it's anxiety, have an antidepressant over a telephone. That, you know, when does, you know, just dismissive gaslighting behaviour become clinical negligence? That's my question to the medical profession, you know, as they hide behind their telephones, triaging these things. And you know, eventually 8 months, 12 months down the line, they get their cardiac MRI and it proves what we already knew from the beginning. They had myocarditis and this ticking time bomb of some subclinical myocarditis. So yeah, in a nutshell, you know, disappointed with my colleagues really for, at this point now, there is no excuse. I mean, the data's out there if you choose to look for it. There's this whole concept, isn't there, of willful blindness or, you know, fear for speaking out, because, you know, I can guarantee it's not been fun the last 2 years speaking out. It's been horrendous, you know, stress, you know, reputational damage. I can't get a job in my home county now. Pretty much every job I've applied for, just ignore my application. And the three that did return an application just said, you're not shortlisted, bearing in mind, you know, we're talking about somebody who's dual trained in A&E and a GP with an immunology, biomedical science, first class honours degree and a master's. So you're kind of like, how has this happened that I don't even make the initial screening process? And bizarre. It's a cancer culture.
It's outrageous. It's outrageous. It's a total injustice. And I would be very angry and outraged, you know, if I was being treated like that, especially when you're being vindicated on a daily basis as more and more information comes out. It's now becoming undeniable what's going on and what happened. And the fact that they're doubling down it just makes it all the worse. Like you say, it's once they become aware of the evidence, ignoring it can no longer be incompetence. Then it becomes willful negligence, doesn't it? Because if the evidence is there, they've been made aware of the evidence, yet continue to administer these jabs that could be killing people, then that's got to be professional criminal negligence, has it not?
It is. I mean, Harold Shipman's the famous doctor that bumped off a load of elderly folk, didn't he? But this is another level, isn't it? It is, to willfully jab people. I mean, look, I've picked really easy wins in my battle publicly on the interviews. You know, as you said from Twitter, I do kind of walk a tightrope a little bit more on there. But, once you get to that point where the fear's gone, you will speak out for humanity. Totally. But, and I speak out not for humanity, I speak out for my kids and your kids and anyone else's kids, because, adults are big enough and ugly enough to look it up themselves and research. If they don't, that's their own fault. But, I've sat on the fence of ethics of informed consent, bodily autonomy, valid refusal of consent, non-coercion. Number two, safety of babies. Three, safety in pregnant women. And four, vaccine injuries. That's the four places of which I've chosen my battles, because if anyone can send me the data that shows that when that first jab went in the first pregnant lady's arm, where was the data in December 2020 saying that it was proven to be robustly safe and effective? Or did we just use pregnant moms as unpaid clinical trial participants and see how it went? And that's exactly what they did. And they did it the same for children. I've been chasing that data for 2 years. If you were under 30 or over 50, you'd be excluded from the clinical trials. If you had any comorbidity whatsoever, if you were pregnant or breastfeeding, you were excluded from the trials. So where's the data that backs the claim that midwives have been using for the last, two or three years, saying it's safe and effective? It might in 10 years' time, when you look back, prove to be safe and effective, but that's the point of the first injection of the first child or the first pregnant mom. That interview I mentioned that I was banned off LinkedIn for, I'm holding up a document from the MHRA, sponsored by Pfizer, MHRA, genuinely. I mean, the amount of financial contributions from Big Pharma, and they're supposed to be the sort of neutral regulatory authority, obviously not. But the document said we shouldn't be vaccinating pregnant moms, and that was June 2021. And we'd be vaccinating healthcare pregnant moms and the at-risk pregnant moms since December 2020. To this day, we're still vaccinating them despite MHRA publishing this document that said we should not be vaccinating pregnant moms and breastfeeding moms. There isn't enough data. This needs looking at further. Yet we're still doing it. Up and down the land now, there are vaccine centres and obstetricians and gynaecologists saying it's absolutely safe. The Royal Colleges of Obs and Gyne have said it's absolutely safe. When you look at the death toll for COVID, 84, 83 in that vicinity with multiple comorbidities. It doesn't kill kids. It doesn't kill young health. There's the infection fatality rates for this cohort, anyone less than 60 really, and in half decent health, carry on with your lives. And it's weird because at the beginning of all this, the government talks about herd immunity, didn't they? Let's segregate the elderly out, the at-risk communities, and we carry on about our daily business. And then that rapidly became sponsored by Pfizer and Moderna, and we moved to this kind of vaccinate everything that moves mentality.
So what you know when the government had that position, which was the herd immunity, or it was Boris, wasn't it, specifically, who had, and he was pilloried in the press and pilloried in the society, but in the community for, even suggesting this idea of herd immunity. What do you think was going on there? Because that seems to me as if Boris's inner circle were off narrative, because they didn't want to go down the other route. And it wasn't long after that he was sent into intensive care, wasn't it, with COVID, and it all changed when he came out. But what's your take on that from your unique perspective?
The whole of the immunology community, they've forgotten this age old concept of natural immunity. And that I think I've heard Fauci say those exact words: the best vaccine in the world for flu is to get the infection. And we've gone so far from that, and to be herd immune through people getting infections and passing them, like chickenpox and chickenpox partners, if you like, to suddenly having to I've heard people say the vaccine's better than natural immunity. I mean, that's just absolutely absurd. I mean, I hear cases of people who've been told You know, they've got proven antibodies. So the reason you have a vaccine is to raise an antibody response to a certain epitope, whether that's a flu protein or a polysaccharide from a bacteria or something like that. But you raise immune response to it, and then through that you get immune memory. Now, I know people who've been sacked from their jobs and they've got confirmed antibodies from a prior natural infection from COVID-19 or alleged COVID-19, and they've got antibody titers in the hand on a document, yet they're being told by their employers that they must still have a vaccine. So they've recovered from the disease, they've got antibodies and T-cell memory for it, yet they're being told to vaccinate for a disease they've recovered from. I mean, how anti-science can you be? And people are being kicked out of their jobs, you know, and they're not allowed to travel. They're being forced and mandated to take these vaccines.
But they were doing the mandates through the back door, weren't they? Because they couldn't legally force us to take them, because the common law protects us from such abuses. So they were using shady tactics in order to manipulate and coerce people by saying, well, look, if you want to go on holiday, you've got to get a vaccine, which is forcing you, isn't it, in its own way, right? And the same within professional institutions. Now, you said that earlier on in the conversation that you took one vaccine and then you took a second vaccine. But the second one, you said you felt as if it was coercion from the medical institution. Can you give us a little bit more detail on that and tell us about the narrative of how that unfolded?
Yeah, I'll put it in context. So every year for the last 3 years, I get asked for the flu jab. The nurse comes around, knocks the door, Dr. Cartland, would you like your flu jab? And I say no. And then they walk off and they bother somebody else who may or may not take it. So put that into context of coercion around COVID. This was just after the carers had all been sacked. I mean, an absolute travesty. They sacked all these carers. Health and social care is on its backside anyway. And then they sack a load of carers because they wouldn't take a medical treatment. So the conversation went something like this: Dave, there's a mandate coming. You're going to have it to protect patients. And, you know, all I knew at that time was that everyone with COVID had had at least two jabs to stop them getting from COVID. And people that, you know, all the death certificates coming through with COVID had been vaccinated two or three times for COVID. So at that point, it was becoming clear to me they didn't work. They didn't do what was said on the table. But it started off with a gentle, you know, it's coming, Dave. It's coming on whenever.
So your suspicions were beginning to be aroused, were they, at this point anyway?
Yeah, exactly. And then the whole kind of, it didn't sit right that they were, you know, they made it. It's pretty much a veiled threat, wasn't it? If you don't have the vaccine, then you're going to get fired. And they were deadly serious, because before me, there were three admin members of staff at the surgery that I worked at. Didn't see a patient. They worked upstairs in the office. They were being told, and these were women that had got kids, and they were going to be fired. And even the practice manager knew that it was not the right thing to do. And I said, well, why are you doing it then? She said, because it's come from above. We have to. It's about protecting patients. But they're not seeing patients. And you'd end up in these circular conversations. But she was prepared to do it, still fire these three friends. They were friends as well. They weren't just colleagues. They were friends.
And where was that coming from? Was that coming from in the higher echelons of the NHS?
Yeah, all I get told is it's coming from above. And again, I can kind of understand that, as I've just done 2 days back in the NHS, where I walked in at 8 o'clock, left at 6:30, and never had a pause for breath all day. And the last thing you want to do when you've had a day like that is pick up the Lancet or the BMJ at the end of the day. You want to see your kids, probably get a glass of wine at that point, you know. And so, you know, and you have to have a level of trust in the layer of the hierarchy above you. At this point, that's not a good enough excuse. But at the start, you kind of realise that due diligence has been done by the chief medical officers of the government and the scientists, the epidemiologists.
Why would they be involved in some kind of conspiracy against the people? You're not going to initially think that, are you? Like you say, you're in a system and you follow the chain of command in order to have efficiency and to be able to get through a day like you've just described.
And, you know, to a degree, I did defend staff at that point. But, I mean, we're 3 years in now, and if you don't know it's a novel gene-based therapeutic, or in inverted commas therapeutic, then, you know, there's no helping you at this point. But, you know, you do place your trust, and I do feel for those doctors and nurses, particularly. I mean, a lot of what I noticed early on, they were letting the nurses run the vaccine program, the nurse practitioners, nurses and junior MMs like EMPs and all that sort of stuff, and paramedic practitioners, they were running the show. And, you know, with respect to them, it's not a medical degree that they've done. And so it's kind of passed down to for them to run it. And these guys would have just been like, you know, the doctor told me to. And the doctors would be saying, because the government told me to, and the government, you know, and it went
all following orders.
Yeah, and they're all just following orders, and that's it. And unfortunately, following orders didn't end well for a certain trial. That's without saying the N-word, because it's Nuremberg. Let's just say, you know, I was just following orders. That's not good enough. You know, and there comes a point where you know, it's your ethical and professional duty to keep up to date. I have to prove every year I've kept up to date with my evidence-based practice. And, you know, 3 years in, you've got to know that it's a novel therapeutic. You've got to know that it's not safe in pregnancy. You've got to know that there's absolutely no clinical case to have this given to babies. I mean, 1 week we were saying 6-month-olds to, I think, 5-year-olds were being authorised to have it. And then 3 weeks later, the government were saying we're cancelling all primary courses for under 50s. You know, it just doesn't make sense. 2 weeks prior, they were after your babies. You know, it's just inconsistency. And or I don't think, looking back at the whole thing, I don't think there's any measures I can say that were logical or sound or scientific. Not one. If anyone,
well, if you speak to Matthias Desmet, he says that one of the elements of a mass formation, of a, you know, a created conscious mass formation, is that they have to have absurd rituals, and the more absurd the rituals, the better for the people who are true believers to get really into the mass formation and receive the psychological benefits that they get from it. Is that he says history shows you that the more absurd the rituals, the better, because like you say, it's some of the things they were getting us to do, but just beyond reason, wasn't it? It was totally, totally, utterly ridiculous. But there was plenty of people who went along with it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I did a Twitter thread the other day about the kids, and they had them 2 meters apart. They had massive inflatables around their midriff and all that stuff. And then there were people in these odd contraptions. They would have like bottles of water that they turned into a mask stuck over their head. You know the images that I'm talking about. There's musicians that have got a mask on, but they've got a little hole in the bit.
So they play the flute.
And there's a guy who went to a little container with a cello, and he was barely able to play the cello because he was in this container. I mean, literally absurd. And people were going along with it. I just put on Twitter about I tried to pay with cash back in the day for the local farm shop, and they said no. Not paying, taking your cash, all the COVID over the notes. And like, people believe that this deadly bubonic plague was sat on a £5 note paying for a pasty. You can't.
I mean, it kind of revealed a weakness in the human psyche for superstition, because I think a lot of that was just like superstition, wasn't it? You know, it was superstition and a bubonic plague and this invisible disease that was killing everyone. And people were so easily manipulated by it. It was quite disappointing as well, I found.
You're right there. You've got patients tell me to this day, you know, that they're being told that their long-term, well, the vaccine injuries, let's call it what it is, are because they had an asymptomatic bout of COVID that's now led to 8 months later causing their neurological consequences. Just so happens to be 2 weeks after their autumn booster, though. It's a mystery, isn't it? You know, and you're being told that you could kill your granny with the disease that you had no symptoms of. I mean, what's wrong with these doctors? I mean, when you say it back to them very slowly, I try and tell them about even the basics of immunology. You've got a human cell being instructed through our mRNA instruction to produce a non-human viral protein. Just so happens to be, you know, the most thrombogenic, pro-inflammatory, autoimmune triggering protein of them all. Just say it back to yourself as a doctor. We're making human cells make a non-human protein. That's only going to cause one thing: inflammation and autoimmunity. And lo and behold, you know, do we know where it goes? No, we don't, because none of the studies looked at biodistribution. None of the studies looked at, you know, carcinogenicity. They didn't look at reproductive toxicity. So if you don't look for these things, you're not going to find. And that's what's happened all the way through with the medical profession, that, you know, if you don't look or you look the other way, then, you know, that's somebody else's issue. You know, they didn't look at the amount of things they didn't look at. People say to me, how long does this last for, this spike protein? We don't know. We don't know. This has been rolled out on the whole world. Man, woman, child, born and unborn. And we don't know how long this spike protein is expressed for. All we know is that it gives an antibody response, and that's all they cared about, antibody response. You know, that you got an immunogenicity response. That was it.
It just seems like it's one gigantic human experiment, doesn't it? That these are the trials, you know, because, you know, there weren't any actual trials, were there, for these vaccines, or they were very, very, very short. But these seem to be the trials. You know, this is the human experiment in the plantation that we're witnessing now.
You've hit it on the head. And I think when people realise they're not only unpaid participants to the biggest worldwide clinical trial for gene therapy / therapy in inverted commas, you know, because there's nothing therapeutic about it. I can't see anything if it doesn't stop transmission or ability to catch, and it doesn't stop your ability to go into hospital with COVID. I mean, I speak to people even now that have had their third, a lady yesterday who was onto her third bout of COVID since her fourth jab, and she just couldn't compute why that would be. And she said those famous words, thank God I had it though, because I'd be dead. you know, they stopped producing the data that showed quite the opposite of that back in February last year, you know, where, you know, rather than openly display the data in ONS form or UKHSA, it was getting very close to sort of 80 to 90% of emergency admissions from COVID were in the fully vaccinated cohorts. And it got that blatant that they just stopped publishing the weekly updates. And, you know, it just doesn't do what it says on the tin in any way, shape or form. But why risk it on babies and pregnant mums and healthy adults?
Because there's weird psychopaths ruled by power, money and greed on who knows what other demonic things that guide these people. But those at the top of Big Pharma, man, they are really some weird, crazy people. What was it like being one of the lone voices within your profession? Did you have other colleagues who were on board with you but didn't want to speak publicly? I mean, what was it like being the whistleblower? Because it takes some courage. It takes some courage and balls to risk everything in service of the truth and justice. But it can be a lonely affair, can't it? What was that like for you on a personal level?
Yeah, I mean, people say it's heroic and this, that and the other. You know, it was a sacrifice. I'm not going to die. I've sacrificed a lot, friends, family, reputation, jobs, etc. But, you know, I don't see it like that. I see it as a following my Hippocratic Oath, for starters, to do no harm. I see it as a, you know, basic duty to keep up to date, to follow medical ethics. It seems absurd that I've been blacklisted and outcast for being promotion of ethics, promotion of safety and promotion of evidence-based medicine. That's it. That's all. And it's very bizarre. But yeah, going back to your question about, you know, what's it like been like to be the lone wolf? Stressful. you know, we're starting to form little pockets now, ever-growing pockets of doctors that are, you know, that we're all thinking the same thing, but within an echo chamber. And it's all about now feeling safe to stand together. And, you know, we did it for a group that I'm part of called Doctors for Patients UK. And I think 17 or 18 people took part in a press release for, you know, just asking to stop the shots, essentially, just while we investigate, a bit like Andrew Bridgen did. You know, all he asked for was investigation. You know, several of the people before the final cut were threatened with the sack for saying ridiculous things like informed consent is important, or, you know, the Hippocratic Oath is a sacred oath that we take at graduation and we should respect it. You know, they're being threatened by their employers with the sack, remove their practice privileges. For that. And so there's that whole fear around speaking out. And I tell you now, I mean, I think 95% of the doctors know now, you know, most of them are just hoping it goes away, sweep it under that big COVID carpet. You know, there's a big chunk of people that contact me daily now, multiple, that are midwives and doctors, and they're saying, well, you know, you've had this right all the time. I won't mention names, but a very senior doctor down here has approached me and said, you know, you were right on everything, but my hands are tied. And he said, my hands are tied. And I tried to probe as to who was tying the hands. And where that came from, but he just had that look of, you know, you knew what he was thinking. And, you know, so many people saying, you know, I would speak out, but we've seen what it's done for your career. And I can't really argue with that, because it's hardly been a joy to sacrifice your career, friends and reputation. I mean, where I live now, people think I'm a lunatic, absolute lunatic. These thoughts around, you know, vaccine safety, you know, little do they realise I've done it for them. I certainly didn't wake up one morning and think, tell you what, I'm going to ruffle some feathers and become an anti-vaxxer and sort of question trust in the medical profession in regards to vaccines. It didn't happen.
Yeah,
like
but you
that.
Were. It sounds like you were threatening when you was making those noises to your superiors, and you were starting to question the narrative, and you were questioning the science, and you were getting pushback from them, right? And you were getting warnings that, you know, you're risking everything, but you chose to double down and keep speaking out. And that takes an extraordinary level of willpower and courage. It really does. And I know you're being modest about it, but I've got masses of respect for you, and I wanted to tell you. Because if we had more people like you in that profession, then we would have less people being damaged by this vaccine and other illnesses, because, you know, our doctors are important. And you make an important point there about your Hippocratic Oath, is that in this country, is that we're governed by consent, right? And the consent we the people transfer to the people running the show is all built on oaths, right? The king takes an oath to uphold the law and keep the peace within the country, and that's why we allow them to be sovereigns. The politicians take an oath of office, police take an oath of office, which is to uphold the peace in the community, and doctors take an oath as well. If those oaths are the foundation stone of how we are governed by consent. They're incredibly important, but they're not given the respect that they should be or used to be, because whoever it is running the show is saying, well, we're not going to uphold you to your oaths anymore. And therefore, that is the crack in the door for the beginning of the corruption that we're seeing now, because they're more interested in their career and their money, you know, in their pensions, than they are in the reason they took the job in the first place and the oath that they promised to uphold.
Yeah, and I think these groups of people as well, they forget that they're there to represent the people pay their wages, MPs and doctors in particular. And there are two sorts of MPs and there's two sorts of doctors. There are those doctors who do it for vocation, and they, you know, they were playing with a stethoscope, listening to the dog's heartbeat with their 2-year-old toy set, and wanted to be all through their life and became. And that's the route I took. Mm. You know, and I remember the exact question, the answer to the question, why did you want to be a doctor, from the med school many, many moons ago now for me. But, you know, there's that career vocation, career MP and career doctor. And I think these are the ones that get to the positions, the high positions now. And run the show, because, you know, it is about prestige, it is about ego, it is about, you know, career promotion, the fancy car, etc. And it's not about ethics anymore. It's not about make your patient your first concern, do no harm. You know, that sort of stuff is a bit old-fashioned. And like you mentioned, oaths are almost superstitious now. They're just, what does that matter? Mm. Very odd times for medicine, really, and it's certainly difficult to be part of that anymore.
I think it's across the board, though, isn't it? I don't think it's just medicine. It's all of our institutions are becoming more and more corrupted, and faith and trust within those institutions is just collapsing. And where does that lead us as a nation, as a country, if we're losing all faith and trust in everything that makes a nation, and we're seeing more and more tyrannical policies and actions by the government, which are telling us is that we don't care about you, the electric, the people. We're just going to tell you what to do, and you're going to follow it. Because if you don't, we're going to impose the monopoly of violence that we have as the state upon you with the threats. You know, because that's what they did with you, a threat. You know, it was a veiled threat. If you don't do this, we're gonna fire you, you know, which is an act of violence in a way, isn't it? You know, so I think we're at a real crossroads in where we're heading as a people, as a nation. And, you know, you're not only speaking out against the terrible damage that's been done over the last 3 years, but you're also kind of an activist with like things like 15-minute cities now as well, and these other things. So give us your take on where we're heading and what we need to do as a people in order to maintain our freedoms, our rights, and the, you know, the country that has been built on the backs of our ancestors over centuries of fighting for those freedoms.
Yeah, I think the modern society forget about those things, don't they? The blood that was shed for where we got to before the COVID pandemic. But as we touched on a bit earlier on in the chat, you know, you need things to break before you can come up with an idea such as a one world government or the WHO treaty, you know, for pandemics of the future. You know, there's this whole, you know, massive World Economic Forum plan, isn't there, to centralise everything and sort of lose the boundaries between countries, etc. You know, we're heading towards the Hunger Games, aren't we? You know, the 15 minutes is so spookily like cutting up places into zones and, you know, under this climate change banner, you know, just, you know, and that encroaches on everything. Even at the surgery I worked at this week, you know, I couldn't print out any paper. Everything had to be electronic for the climate change. They were going around turning lights off and everything. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of nonsense going around at the moment, and we just need to stand up and realise, you know, if we don't speak up now, it's going to be too late. Well, it's probably is too late, to be honest, because
plans it's never are too late. Never give up. Never give up. But I think it's important that, you know, our doctors have this holistic approach to what's going on in the world on a wider level, because my experience with GPs has never been particularly positive. It's always, I felt like I'm having to persuade him to get the treatment that I need, or does he really know what's going on? Unlikely, because if GPs are having the day that you described on a daily basis, which is 11 hours nonstop, go home, have a glass of wine, they're not going to be looking into any red pill material, are they? Because, you know, it's a full-time job. So I think it's important that in a world where these professionals have become hyper-specialized, where they only know a lot about a very tight area of information and knowledge. I don't think that's particularly good. I think, you know, GPs should have a broader knowledge. Doctors should have a broader knowledge of what's really going on, who's behind the big pharma scam, what these drugs really mean. Are there other treatments out there that don't cost any money that are just as effective? I think it's, you know, that's definitely where we need to be heading in the future. And I think, you know, you're shining a light.
No, I agree. It's we need to start waking up the medical profession now. And you know those sort of days that you just mentioned and we talked about earlier. You know, you don't have the energy to look into things deeply. And so I hear now doctors quoting the BBC, or you know, as their source of medical. I mean, back to even only 5 years ago, it would be the Lancet or the BMJ or the Journal of Nature. Now it's the BBC being discussed. And again, you know, these doctors are learning from sources that are telling them what the status quo is and what, rather than looking at a clinical paper, appraising it, look at the statistical analysis that was used. You know, are there any methodology issues? Is there any conflicts of interest even at the bottom of the paper? Who funds it? Only just recently Cochrane have come out with the masks don't work article, only to find out 2 days ago that guess who's just made a rather large donation to it? The Bill and Gates Foundation. You know, you can't write this stuff, you know, and the sooner we realise that we are just the puppets of Big Pharma, then we're just going to keep going through eat, sleep, repeat.
I think it's great though that we're having these conversations, because it shows that, you know, if the situation was hopeless, propaganda would be unnecessary. But the fact that they have to pump out the propaganda on 24 hours a day, it shows that the situation isn't hopeless, right? And, you know, this constant attempts to keep us suppressed is causing more and more people to become aware and push back. So before we wrap this up, I just want to focus a little bit on people who may be watching this, who have taken the jab, they regret it, they're feeling, you know, not 100%, and they're kind of dreading this information, to be fair. Psychologically, they're dreading this information. Is what treatments are out there? What can you do? How can you help people who may see this and think, I want to get in touch with David, and what practical advice can you give to people who may be suffering from this this terrible crime?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of movement now happening, not just with my own website, but lots of other groups that are sort of banding together now to build kind of connections of doctors that are awake to the possibilities of, you know, how do we resolve this? I call it spike proteinopathy. I don't know where that came from, but it's sort of stuck. You know, your body's producing spike protein incessantly. And there's lots, you know, you're not going to get Pfizer to sponsor your trial on, you know, what's the benefit of vitamin D in COVID vaccine injuries, are you? Because A, they don't believe vaccine injuries are even a thing. And B, vitamin D is really cheap and effective. So it's not going to, you're not going to, so a lot of what I'm trying to say, it's anecdotal evidence. So people will come to me and say, I've had this brain fog for weeks and weeks, and I've had some hyperbaric oxygen therapy and it worked wonders. I feel like my batteries have been recharged. So I'll make a note of that in my little document here, and add it to the list and start researching it and see, you know, has anyone else experienced this? And then lo and behold, you see a trend of people improving with hyperbaric oxygen. And then I'll pass that forward to other vaccine injury. And there's a whole list, there's 3 or 4 pages here of what I've looked and researched into. Other doctors are doing it now. We're building a bit of a database through Doctors for Patients UK as to doctors who are doing their research and due diligence on some of these things. You know, a lot of it's supplementation, a lot of it's nutritional, getting your gut biome right, you know, getting the exercise and diet that's right. Lots of different
and
diets.
This can help mitigate or reverse some of the effects of vaccine damage.
Yeah, I mean, the only answer I can say to that is some people do, some people don't. And, you know, that it's difficult to predict. I mean, I've not seen a vaccine injury that's the same textbook account from any one patient to the next. That's what's been ultimately really bizarre, managing them. You know, the same ghastly lighting and the same abuse from the medical professional, but their timelines are different and the systems affected are different. One's an autoimmune condition, the next person's a neurological condition. But, you know, it doesn't pigeonhole into a particular known medical condition. And these people are going to get scanned and then the scans don't show anything because, you know, they're looking for macroscopic pathology, something you can see on a scan, whereas we know this spike protein is happening on a microscopic level. So we've got microscopic clots, microinflammation, you know, micro autoimmunity. And what you're looking at there is, you know, looking at ways of reducing inflammation in the body. This is the 3 areas that I look at, you know, reducing inflammation, getting your immune system in check, through supplements and a diet that's right, etc. And looking at microclotting as well. And these people have the tests done and it doesn't show anything, and then they're sort of put down as functionally neurologically unwell, so i.e. they're making it up, or they're mentally unwell because the scan of the head didn't show anything. But it's not looking at the degree of definition that needs to be to delineate from these microscopic pathologies. So, I mean, doctors would think you're talking pseudoscience hearing what I've just said in the last 2 minutes, but you know, we need to start trying these things. And like I say, lots and lots of anecdotal evidence of benefit in combinations of things like the natokinase is the big one, zeolite's another one, or the vitamin supplements like the vitamin D, C, B, magnesium, zinc. All of those have got evidence base to them. And I kind of guide people to more established protocols as well as my own research in terms of things like the FLCCC protocol, which is a Canadian. Looks at lots of different scenarios, but the one is the vaccine injury protocol, iRecover, I think they call it. And the second one is the World Council for Health. They've got a very good spike protein detox treatment. So, you know, it's about getting those things right as well, and actually just being heard. And actually, you know, sometimes that's therapy, as we talked about earlier, in itself, just to be heard, just to have that platform to speak and to be heard. And to not be gaslit, that's helpful as well.
That's one of the hardest things, though, isn't it? The gaslighting, it's outrageous, the gaslighting. It's victim blaming, isn't it? You know, that's what the gaslighting is. It's real coward's tactics to use gaslighting against people who've got health concerns and things that are happening to them that have been a result of, you know, this vaccine damage, and yet they turn around and called, pull yourself together, or, you know, you're making this up in your head. I mean, that's the lowest of the low.
Yeah, I had a patient a couple of weeks ago saying that she heard because they were only the other side of a curtain, and she'd had a reflex check, and reflexes are reflexes. You can't override them consciously. Mm. And she had absent plantars, which is where you tickle the foot and the toes curl, or they go backwards if you had a stroke. And she had absent plantars, which is a sign of pathology. You can't make that up. And she heard the consultant say, oh, this, she's a good one. This is a good actress. She's faking her plantars. She heard it with her own ears. And this is why I don't recognize my profession, because, you know, I just plead with them to speak out now and say what they're seeing in their own clinic rooms, just to connect the dots, be brave, you know, remember the answer to the question that you gave when you were asked back in the pre-medical school phase of things, why did you become a doctor? What were the reasons? What were your motivations? And just forget, you know, the implications of speaking out for now. Remember the oath you took, remember the reasons you became a doctor. And you know, you're there to advocate for your patients at the end of the day, not to gaslight them and ridicule them and tell them they're
there's
mental.
An institutional, I find there's an institutional arrogance due to a lack of accountability. Is that it's, you know, the amount of medical negligence that actually gets prosecuted or is successful in the courts is really low compared to the actual, you know, amount of times medical negligence happens. And as a result, it creates this untouchable nature in some NHS professionals, because I had a debate with one of them on my Instagram, and I was just shocked by his level of arrogance, right, towards me, who ultimately pays his wages, because they are public servants. They're public servants. They work for us. We pay the wages. And you know, I think there's this detachment from the people who they're serving is creating this environment within medicine.
Yeah, there is an ego, as you mentioned, almost arrogance of doctors. Mm. And, you know, I always remember I had it yesterday where a patient came in and they were an expert patient. And it makes you feel inherently uneasy that you don't know as much as they do. And you've got all your medical degrees and all your letters after your name. And this is a dustman that's come in and he's researched the subject and he knows it all. And it just makes you feel uneasy. And the best way to deal with that is to dismiss what they're saying to you. Just completely gaslight them and just, you know better. And it's going to create a really unusual dynamic. And, you know, for patients going in, for example, with concerns about vaccines to their doctor. I've seen it myself. I worked at a surgery where a lady wrote a lovely letter. She didn't rant. It was very logical, points about concern right at the beginning at the surgery that I initially left from. And it went round on a joint email, CC'd all the doctors in saying, watch out for this anti-vaxxer, essentially, to paraphrase. And
what about the patient?
Yeah, but the patient had written some letters, questions of a doctor. Is this ethical? You know, do we know the long-term outcomes of mRNA, for example? And I read down the list and I remember putting the email out saying, this lady's got some really good points. What are the answers? Rather than ridiculing it. Mm. Rather than getting an answer myself, it went up on the notes. Please read this patient's notes and attach the email, which then scanned into a notes. you know, saying that she was an anti-vaxxer and watch out, you know, watch out when Doris comes to see you or whatever her name was, you know,
blacklisting her.
What she did was, and it's propagated from there, the gaslighting has. Doctors that have spoken out, you know, that's the, you know, similar consequence. You know, I'm an anti-vaxxer. All I've got is names. I just keep saying, give me the data. I'm happy to be wrong, by the way, on all of this. If you can rehabilitate me, if you can show me the error of my statistical misanalysis, sit down with me. But in 2 years, not one doctor, not one, has sat down with me and said, Dave, you got it wrong. And I hope to be wrong still even to this day.
They never do. They won't debate you. And not even on COVID, on all of the other points of the agenda that we've kind of touched on, but I touch upon in other podcasts, is they always refuse to debate you because they don't have the truth on their side. And deep down, they know it. They know it because if they did believe in it, they would have no problem taking a platform to ridicule you and destroy your argument with truth and facts. But they don't. They never take you up on the offer.
Yeah, I said that early on. I said, you know, very easy, quick way of showing Dr. Cartland's a lunatic. Give him the data. Show everyone. Publicly humiliate him. You know, there's been protesters in my locality that have gone and just begged their doctors for the data of safety in pregnancy, for example. And they've just been, in fact, they call the police. The doctors call the police on them, which is bizarre. And, you know, the very easy way to disperse these crazy anti-vaxxers, isn't there? Give them the safe and effective data. Show them. You know, there's nothing better than to reassure a patient with the evidence that this is safe and effective. But there's been a lack and sparsity of data being given to patients. All they do is repeat the same old safe and effective, safe and effective, safe and effective. And you can make them very uncomfortable very quickly. Like, go and ask your jab center to go and give you an AstraZeneca booster, see what they say. Ask them what the results are, see what they say. You need to push your doctors a little bit more, the public do. And, you know, the burden of proof is on them to prove it's safe and effective, not for the patient who is, you know, under the knowledge of the doctor to prove it's unsafe and ineffective. You know, if I say this pill is effective and you say, well, show me the data, I have to be able to show you that.
One of the most triggering things that you can ask a repeater, right, is show me the evidence. And that's across the board. The moment you say show me the evidence and they're just someone who's repeating what they've been conditioned to say, you know, they get upset and angry because they haven't got any evidence, have they? You know, they haven't got anything to bring to the table. But just before we finish, I think you touched on something there that I think I'd like to, you know, get a little bit more clarity on, which is, what advice can you give to patients who have to face GPs who are resistant to hearing their concerns? What's the best way for a patient to approach their GP in order to get the care that they deserve?
Well, if I knew the answer to that, I would...
Is there a way of, like, you know, writing a letter, evidence-based, having the authorities, is taking into the doctor to put him in a position where he can't refuse, basically, is that he can't just gaslight you because you can then say, well, hang on a minute, this is, you have to counter this, or is, am I barking up, wasting my time there?
Those letters that come into the surgery go straight in the shredder. I've been a signatory to many letters over the last 2 years. You know, they've gone to the right people. People kept saying to me, even in the hierarchy of the medical spheres, really, that I'm in, that you should write letters rather than do these interviews in obscure places. You're losing all credibility speaking to X, Y, and Z. Well, we've written those letters and they end up in the shredder. We've written them to the Prime Minister, the Health Secretary, the new Health Secretary, the new one after that, you know, however many health secretaries we had in 6 months. It's absolute insanity, but, you know, just be calm and ask for the evidence. Like I said, the burden of proof is on the claimant. You know, it's not the punter. And actually, you know, for example, you know, Dr. Cartland said on a podcast the other day that Spikevax bivalent hasn't been tested on humans. It's only been tested on mice. And then they've got to disprove that Dr. Cartland's mad and show you the human trials. It didn't get tested on humans, by the way. The Spikevax bivalent. And so this is where you need to stand firm and ask for evidence. For example, you know, patients go in, you know, 2 days after the vaccine and this symptom is developed and the doctors completely knock the ball out of the park and say, no, it's absolutely not the vaccine. Well, why? Why is it not? Why was it healthy last week? And then what else do you think is going on? And they don't. They just get told they're mentally unwell.
Is that potentially medical negligence when they say that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, this is what I said earlier. I mean, the amount of vaccine injury cases that I deal with that are, you know, barn door clinical negligence cases. I'll give you one example just to sort of demonstrate the point. Patient had fits after their booster, after the third jab, started to have a nocturnal fits, and the husband recorded the episode, sent it into the doctor, who made a telephone consultation. And the telephone consultation for a fit, you know, this is an emergency, somebody started fitting out of the blue, had a telephone consultation and ended up with an antidepressant from a telephone consultation for fitting. You know, there was another lady who called a GP. She stroked out in front of the dentist. Dentist sent her in a taxi back to call the doctor. She's fast positive, droopy face, the rest of it. Went to phone a doctor who organised a blood test for 3 days' time. She collapsed in those 3 days, went into the hospital with a second stroke. And this is the case I used the example of earlier about the doctor was saying, this one's a good actress. And she had a full-on facial nerve palsy. You can't make that up. It's like she's making up a droopy face. Well, this is bizarre. I mean, it's clinical negligence and it's criminal negligence, actually. Mm.
Okay, cool. I'm going to leave it there. Really great chatting to you. I really appreciate it. Like I said, I've got massive respect for you and I wish there were more doctors like you. Have you got any final words for people who are watching this that may, want to get in touch with you or anything like that?
Yeah, firstly, just all my recent interviews, I just beg the doctors that are awake and are scared to speak out, number one. And number two, if you are concerned about anything vaccine injury related, not only through me, but, Doctors for Patients UK is a group that I'm involved in, and there's lots of doctors that are there that can help, listen, advise, signpost. And it's not all negative. There's lots and lots of positives from dealing with vaccine injury cases where people have had at least an improvement in their symptoms, if not full resolution. And, people are getting better with time. Time is helping people, whether you don't do anything or not. So there's lots of hope here. There's a lot of hopelessness in the world at the moment, but, my big list of things here, lots of it's working. So just get in touch with either myself or any other doctors that are speaking out. Look at those protocols I mentioned, the FLCCC, all these blasphemous medicines like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine and vitamin D, all this horse paste, there's evidence for it. So, search for yourselves, become experts in your own right, so that you've got all the information when you do attend the doctors and that you're sticking to data, stick to facts always. It's so easy to slip into conspiracy and speculation, but stick to data, stick to facts, and you can't go wrong there.
Fantastic. And where can people find you, David? Whereabouts are you online? I know you've been you've been kicked off a few platforms, haven't you, so far?
Yeah, so like you said, I've been kicked off most Twitter. I'm at Cartland David, Getter. Mm-hmm. And that's about it. Okay. DrCartland.com is my website, just to give that a plug.
Well, I highly recommend David's Twitter profile. It's very entertaining, very passionate about what he says and what he posts. Really good. It's been great chatting to you. I really appreciate you giving me the time to do that. And I hope to speak to you again soon.
No, it's been good to chat. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
No worries.